For those of you who are new members of this church, or who may be visiting us on this late summer Sunday, this is a potpourri sermon. And a potpourri sermon is a kind of grab bag, a collection of the odds and ends of my experience and reading as pulpit minister of this church, shared in bits and pieces because they do seem worth sharing, although I have no wish to make a full sermon out of any one of them. So here they are: hypocrisy, slogans, and headless queens. A sequence I chose for the title because it has a nice rhythm, but which I do not intend to follow. I mean in order. Let's start with the headless queens. A Texas newspaper woman wrote a column recently about an accident at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. It seems that the ants living in one of the big display cases beheaded their queen. Not on purpose, apparently. Their keeper thinks that they were trying to move their egg-laying queen from one chamber to another. But the hole through which they had to pull her was small, and queen ants are large, and so, pop, there went her head. What the ants did next has some implications for education, politics, and religion, so I thought I should share it with you in case you missed it. What the ants did was to react like a lot of us do when we realize we've made a bad mistake. They pretended nothing had happened. That is, when the keeper looked, they were still tending the queen. Her headless thorax and abdomen hung suspended from the ceiling of the royal chamber, her legs dangling, or at least two legs dangled. The other four had vanished at the same time her head was lost. The ants didn't know it, but it was all an exercise in futility. No matter how carefully they tended their headless queen, the colony was finished. Without a queen, a colony gets no eggs, because that is what a queen ant does. She lays eggs. And if she doesn't, there are no workers. And eventually, the colony gets too small to function. It struck me that I was reading a kind of parable that all of us are involved in the work of tending headless queens. Our government does it when it clings tenaciously to the idea that it is better to have a bloodthirsty tyrant in power who professes to be a capitalist than it is to have a decent leader who leans out of compassion for his people towards some ideas that are socialistic. I believe in capitalism, but we have supported some terrible leaders simply because they shared our economic preference. I watch schools and clubs and businesses that base their schedules and what they demand of their employees or members on the headless queen idea of the, quote, traditional American family, in which the daddy works and the mama stays home to clean the house, wait for repairmen, run errands, and chauffeur the children. That profile may fit a fourth or even a third of American families, but many of our notions about home life seem as unrealistic as the work of those ants. And what about our insistence on living as if we had unlimited supplies of fossil fuels, because we're so devoted to our headless queen of unlimited oil that we will exploit the scenic wilderness left, put whole ecosystems at risk with massive oil spills, and even go to war to guarantee the supply, rather than take even the simplest steps toward conservation. If that's too large an issue and too remote to worry about, then I would remind you of our personal lives, in which we spend more time and energy tending the headless queens left over from our childhood than we do on the current realities of our lives. Think of the people you know who are still tangled up with old angers and old myths and old labels hung on them years ago by well-meaning parents, overzealous preachers, or ill-informed peers. So while we smile at the ants, it might be useful to ask how many headless queens we may be tending ourselves. Item number two. Years ago, I published a little article entitled Slogan Mentality, in which I argued that religion is done a disservice by those fatuous slogans one so often sees on church bulletin boards and automobile bumpers. I realize that fatuous is not a word we use often, but it expresses perfectly what many of these slogans are like. It means a kind of unconscious stupidity. It means being asinine with an air of smug self-righteousness. Honk if you love Jesus. It would embarrass that splendid Son of God to death. I caught a quick glimpse on a recent trip of a church sign with this silly little maxim printed on it: lean on Jesus before he leans on you. Now, the lucky ones of you who are not much bothered by idiotic theology will think I should just blink twice and drive on. But I'm hopelessly tangled up with theology, and that coy, cute little threat cast a shadow over the next 20 miles. And then there was the one I saw in Wichita one day: God is dog, spelled backwards, and he really is man's best friend. A moment of tail-wagging inspiration I would love to forget, but which sticks in my memory like an unwelcome burr. I happen to think the whole idea of God is too majestic and marvelous for cute little word games. If anybody out there is sometimes irritated by these shallow pieces of roadside moralizing, maybe it will comfort you, as it has me, to know that one of the most brilliant English women of the 19th century felt the same way. She had a reading audience in mind when she wrote. So you have to concentrate now a little harder as listeners, but it's worth it. Please listen carefully to her wise comment. And I have a couple of parenthetical interjections that I will throw in as we go. It starts like this. All people of broad, strong sense, and that's you, of course, have instinctive repugnance toward the maxim makers, slogan makers, because such people, that is the sensible people, discover early that the mysterious complexity of our life is not to be embraced by slogans, and that to lace ourselves up in formulas of that sort is to repress all the divine promptings and inspiration that spring from growing insight and sympathy. Now that is splendidly done, but if you want it reduced to a pulpit nutshell, it says that slogans are simply too shallow and that we ought to outgrow them, even quarrel with them, because otherwise they keep us on the intellectual and religious level of children. When something annoys us, like this slogan business, but doesn't seem to bother a lot of other healthy citizens, we tend to wonder if we may not have a secret screw loose someplace. So it's comforting to report that the witty Mr. James Thurber also scowled at these faintly pompous little adages, knowing perfectly well that many of them can actually be reversed without losing an ounce of truth, which is just what he did in one of his essays by way of illustration. He who hesitates is sometimes saved. It may be a rather bizarre little tidbit I'm serving up to you this morning, but I happen to believe that your mental and spiritual life will both be enriched if you will let yourself have brief quarrels with these pretentious little bits of nonsense. You are, after all, believers in a religion that has a cross at the heart of it, a mysterious and puzzling paradox that is only cheapened by cute and pious little slogans. If nothing else, if you'll have a quarrel with those things, it can help make routine trips around town or out of town a little more exciting, because there'll always be a church or a business that thinks the world will be a better place if it spells out a slogan on a sign. And it may have been divine punishment visited upon me, but this very day, as I drove from the house, I was greeted by one that said, "Falling hurts least those who fly low." Now that must have reference to planes. And most pilots will say that once you're airborne, it isn't going to make much difference. So it isn't very well considered in the first place. And what is it, finally? A prescription to diminish ambition and to fly low? Surely that isn't the intended message. I think it just went up on the sign without any thought at all, and that's what's wrong with most of them. And finally, since this is an eccentric sort of Sunday sermon anyway, let me suggest that hypocrisy, which the church has always rightly detested, does, after all, pay virtue a kind of backhanded compliment. and may not be altogether as bad as it seems. There is a wise old saying, not a slogan, but a thoughtful reflection, that hypocrisy is the tribute vice pays to virtue. In other words, apart from the contempt he brings on himself, the hypocrite actually performs one valuable function. By pretending to be better than he is, he publicly supports the standards of ethics and morality which he is breaking in private. This is the one that gave me most concern. Please listen carefully and forgivingly. There is something here, I think. Our current problem is that hypocrisy has been given such a bad name that it's about to disappear. People are pursuing their age-old vices with as much energy as ever, but instead of having the decency to be discreet, they now flaunt their vices in public and claim that their vices have been turned into virtues simply because everybody can see them. It was the rector of an Episcopal church who got me thinking about this odd topic. He certainly did not approve of marital infidelity, for example, but he preferred the older sense that it was at least something one ought not to publish. A person, he wrote, who felt unfulfilled in marriage used to have a quiet affair, often in another city. Today, such a person is likely not only to establish a sexual liaison among friends and co-workers, but also to discuss the matter freely with anyone who will listen, including a spouse. I'll give you a copy of this later if you want to study it a bit. In the public arena, this colleague of mine goes on to say, the vice of withholding criminal evidence has been given the virtuous-sounding name of executive privilege. Public officials, when caught in a lie, instead of admitting that, yes, lying is evil, declare that lying is a virtue known as protecting national security. So he says, and I join him heartily, that instead of simply condemning hypocrisy, religious people might be well advised to see the hypocrites of this world as some of their strongest allies in upholding standards of public and private morality. Give me, he says, a practicing hypocrite any day rather than a person who claims openly that darkness is light or that his vice is in reality a virtuous action. Think about it. If you have loyally stayed with me this far, and at least two have, I'll try to close out the remarks about hypocrisy on a level that's a little more relaxed. I want you to think of how essential it is in ordinary human relationships to do a little pretending. On the simplest level of all, for example, to pretend that we feel better than we actually feel. It is gallantry, not hypocrisy, to pretend at the party that we are just fine instead of announcing how terrible our headache is and spoiling the fun for everybody. Imagine what a kink it would throw into friendships if we were to reply each time someone asks, how are you, that our back hurts dreadfully, that our feet don't get enough circulation in cold weather, that our sinuses are plugged, and that we can't sleep as soundly as we used to. How are you actually means little more than, hello, nice to see you. That's all. Nobody really expects to hear a litany of our woes. If we hope for friends, we have to pretend that things are better with us than they are. That kind of pretense has something to do with what is meant by agape love, that Christian love which causes us to act better than we really feel like acting. I take race relations, for example. White or black, we cannot easily change the way we feel about our opposite number, even if we are commanded to change. Because our feelings were not formed rationally, and they may not be subject to rational control. But by an act of will, we can act right even if we feel wrong. Given enough practice, if we keep acting right, we are likely to begin feeling right. It just works that way. Our attitudes can change because of our overt behavior. We can convince ourselves on a deeper level sometimes because on the surface we're doing what's right even if we don't feel like it. When we were commanded to love people, including our enemies, it was never imagined that we could like everybody. Liking springs from our feelings and cannot be commanded. Loving, in the New Testament sense, is a determination to treat people as if we like them, even when we don't. It is, therefore, a pretending of sorts. But it makes the world a good place to live in, and it finally makes the one who does the right thing because she has to into a person who does the right thing because she wants to. I'll try to be a little more conventional next week, if you'll come back, and not bother you about slogans and headless queens and unexpected praise for hypocrisy. But I have not been frivolous. I believe that the truth about how God wants us to live can be found even in the strange things we have considered today. And I trust you to find that truth. Thank you, as always, for listening so patiently and so well.